I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In. My guest today is Jay Joseph, a clinical psychologist practicing in the San Francisco Bay Area with a special interest in nature-nurture issues and genetic research in the social and behavioral sciences. He is the author of four books, most recently The Trouble with Twin Studies, a reassessment of twin research in the social and behavioral sciences, in 2015, and Schizophrenia and Genetics, The End of an Illusion, published in 2017. Also a contributor to the website Mad in America and the creator of the GeneIllusionBlogspot.com. So, Jay Joseph, welcome to Delving In.
Thank you. Great to be here and be able to talk with you today.
So before we get into the meat of your argument that the evidence for the biological components of mental illnesses, especially serious mental illnesses, is flawed and grossly overestimated, what makes this issue so important that you have devoted several books and book chapters, numerous articles and blog postings to it for well over two decades? I think that would be helpful to sort of understand the context before we delve into the nitty-gritty, because the nitty-gritty can be pretty technical in a way, and I think it would be nice to know why this is so important.
Okay, good question. First of all, I specialize in the genetic aspect. Biological would include biological malfunction of the brain, which I don't believe that there's evidence for that for psychiatric disorders, but it's not my specialty. My specialty is the genetic component. I think it's very important because it really affects how we see people suffering mental distress, disorder, whether we see this as something caused within their body or whether it's something that's socially caused, environmentally caused, which in which case we would need to have social and political policies that really aimed at changing the environment and making the environment psychologically more healthy. Current theories that are more about, you know, biology and genetics are focused away from that. So no need to change people's environment. It's the current theories are that it's, you know, brain biology and genetics. So how, you know, the people's environment and how people are treated, you know, in the worst case scenario, you have the history of eugenics and where, you know, people are sterilized or worse, where they're perceived or, you know, claimed genetic disorder that they're born that way. And so that's kind of in the worst case scenario. But in the best case scenario, it's not doing much to change people's environments because of perceived genetic component.
If I'm reading you right, your concern is that the over-reliance or the too strong belief in the biological determination of mental illness has cultural implications in the way we view ourselves and also the way we treat each other and the way we apportion resources to helping people who are suffering.
Yes, definitely, you know, and political policies and social policies. Yes, it is a big effect. And the way I like to put it is whether we're talking about psychological, psychiatric disorders, whether distress dysfunction is caused by sources within the body or outside of the body. That's really, you know, where do we focus? So, you know, my focus is that, we need to focus outside of the body, not inside, because the causes do not lie there.
And of course, there's implications for funding as well. I mean, it seems that the biological aspect gets the lion's share of the funding for grants and things like that, and as well as funding researchers who are graduate students and so on.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, we can never forget, you know, the influence of the pharmaceutical companies, because they and mainstream psychiatry, you know, they need to claim that mental disorders are caused, you know, if they're real medical disorders that need medical treatments and medication. And to legitimize that position, it's important to establish a genetic biological foundation. But critics argue that the evidence is not very good for that. But there's an economic need to establish that, even if the evidence isn't very good.
Okay, I have a second preliminary question, and that's, it seems that the genetic explanations for major mental illness, whether it's for schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depression, serious anxiety disorders, are strongly appealing to the general public. There seems to be a near universal belief, for instance, that children come into the world with different aptitudes, intellectual potential, and especially temperaments, such as shy versus bold, energetic versus calm, accommodating versus demanding, high needs versus easygoing, bold versus timid, and so on and so forth. That seems to be pretty much a given. Anyone who's had more than one child will say that, oh yes, the child came into the world with, you know, a lot of differences from the first child. If such traits seem so largely inborn, You know, even though, of course, they can be influenced by the environment. If you have a very shy child, if you are a good parent, you might be able to help the child largely overcome the shyness. Or if they're overly demanding, you might be able to help them to become more accommodating. So you can shape it to some extent. It seems that it's sort of a given without necessarily having to have proof other than widespread anecdotal evidence. So it seems almost a given, I think, to the general public, even without all the marketing by, let's say, the pharmaceutical companies, that mental illnesses must have a temperament or some kind of genetic component as well. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are about that.
Well, I think we're talking about different things. If you're talking about temperament, intelligence, these things versus kind of, I think the main thing we're talking about today, psychiatric disorders, so schizophrenia, bipolar, depression, these kind of things. So, you know, which I think that there's no evidence for a genetic component for those, whether people want to say some people are born smarter than others or different temperament. The main thing I have to say about that is whether or not that's true, the research methods used to determine a genetic component are faulty, which I suppose I'll get into later. But it's also a question of why research, you know, why are we so concerned about this? You know, why not create environments, eliminate oppression, poverty, racism, all of these things, homophobia? Why not create a society where all of the harmful aspects of society are eliminated and let people just kind of be who they are? Not why we have to focus research and money and funding on, you know, whether people are different. And also, I would say a lot of these differences are magnified. For example, the field of behavioral genetics, they tend to magnify and say people are very different, as opposed to, in general, we're all have pretty similar in a lot of ways, even if people want to say that children are different, you know, born differently. Why are people so concerned about that as far as in the research area, psychiatry and psychology?
Well, would you agree that even in the absence of evidence that it's plausible, if not likely, that people come into the world with different vulnerabilities? So for instance, some people under stress, they have trouble with their stomachs or their digestive system. Other people have trouble with blood pressure, and other people have prone to anxiety when they're under stress. Other people maybe other kinds of things. So it's awfully hard to measure these things, you know, how much vulnerability is there. It's, I don't know, it just seems to me that not everyone is going to become, let's say, have a manic episode under stress. Some people will have their own individual kind of reaction depending on what their vulnerabilities are. Of course, the stress, you could still say the stress part of it is critical. In other words, without a certain threshold of stress, then even if you have a vulnerability, it doesn't mean it's going to get expressed.
So how I like to respond to that is people might have a lot of ideas about the world. They might, like what you were just mentioning, might be a very fine way of looking at things, but the area I focus on is that the scientific evidence stating that there's a predisposition of some kind, is lacking, and it's been kind of negatively confirmed by, you know, the failure to discover genes, which they've been looking for since the 1960s for mental disorders, also for, you know, psychological traits, IQ, personality. There's been a total failure to identify genes that cause mental disorders. They have new kinds of methods are always coming out.
Yeah, and as you point out in your writings, there's a tendency to to overestimate these things. One other thing before we go on is that in terms of the popular bias toward genetic determinism, there was a really interesting article in 2018 in the New York Times Magazine called "The Mixed Up Brothers of Bogota," and there's a documentary in 2018 called "Three Identical Triplets," who, as part of a medical study, were separated at birth, which doesn't usually happen, and we'll get into that. In the documentary, it's really remarkable how they were pressured to be more similar in their mannerisms. That somehow the public got a kick out of this, to have these three identical triplets separated at birth. They discover each other in their, I guess, 20s, I think, and they're so alike. Oh, look how alike they are. There's something charming, I think, for the public about that, whether it's true or not. There seems to be a desire, in a way, to see oneself as determined in that way. And I think they themselves, I think, felt otherwise after all the publicity.
Yes, I saw the movie. I wrote an article about it, pretty lengthy article. It's posted at Mad in America. I enjoyed the movie immensely. It was very entertaining, interesting movie, very well done. But, you know, nothing about that movie really proves or even suggests anything about genetic influences on behavior. And separated twin studies is, you know, one area that I've looked really closely at. First of all, a lot of what they were doing was staged for publicity. You know, they would go in, they were putting on a show that they wanted to, yeah, they were staged for publicity, but also genetic researchers who have a genetic agenda always also put these, you know, pairs and triplets forward as evidence, very powerful evidence. They say behavior is, you know, largely in the genes. So you have kind of a coinciding of, you know, interests. And a lot of times a pair, they get publicity, they make money, they go on TV, they get fame from, you know, otherwise maybe not so famous lives. But the biggest thing about all of this is that even perfectly separated identical twins share a lot of environmental similarities in common. This is something that's always forgotten. So in this case, first of all, they're males. So males are socialized to behave more similarly. So they're all males. They grew up at the same time. They grew up in the same birth cohort in the New York City area. So they experience similar cultural influences at the same time. They're influenced by events in life and society, political wars, these things that people experience. They were all raised to be Jewish. There's a religious, the religion is a powerful teacher of how to behave and to think. And there are many, many others. They look alike. There are all these other non-familiar environmental influences that confound genetic interpretations, if I could put it that way, that you can't really say nature and nurture. It's not just the family. There are many, many, I've listed over 30 environmental influences other than the family that separated identical twins experience.
Before we get into that, so we're talking about the intertwining of nature and nurture. Could you explain in what way twin studies have been used to supposedly prove something that you were, I mean, what is it that you're arguing against is what I'm asking.
Well, twin studies are shown, are put forward as providing evidence for important, strong genetic influences. So let's say we just stay to the area of psychiatry. These are all studies of twins reared together. They're identical twins, which I'll call identical, but they're MZ, monozygotic twins, and fraternal twins, DZ, dizygotic twins. Identical twins are genetically identical 100%. Fraternal twins, on average, are 50%. So in psychiatry, there are no separated twin studies. It's all studies of groups of identical and groups of fraternal twins. And they compare, in psychiatry, the concordance rate. So when one twin has a disorder, how often does the other twin have it? And, you know, in general, identical twins' behavior is more similar, and they have more likely to have the same psychiatric disorders fraternal twins. So the genetic researchers in every textbook you will pick up will tell you that this must be caused by genetics. But what critics argue is that, you know, identical twins have much more similar environments, attachment to each other, identity confusion, and this could be the cause.
In other words, the claim that's being made is that this is akin to a natural experiment. That we're going to hold the genetics constant, or not we, but nature does, because they're identical twins, and then any differences are going to be purported to be because of the environment. Isn't that pretty much the claim? And that what you're saying is that it's not really so easy to tease apart the two.
Right. It's not easy at all, because not only are they treated, they're raised to be the same. They spend more time together. They're more closely attached. They experience identity confusion. If you look at studies that look at the level of attachment and identity confusion of identical twins, it's far, far greater than fraternal twins. They're raised and they're socialized and they look alike to be more similar. So if their behavior is more similar, or they're more likely to have the same psychiatric disorder, we really can't say whether that's genes or environment. In other words, in research, the term is confounded. Environmental factors confound environmental interpretations of identical fraternal comparisons. This is what critics have been saying for 100 years.
For 100 years?
Long before I came on the scene. Well, since the 1930s, so almost.
Right. So these studies were done like from the 30s to the 70s, something like that, of the 20th century. So there was kind of mid-20th century, approximately, give or take 20 years.
Well, twin research was started by Francis Galton, who's the, you know, one of the pioneers of psychology and also the originator of the eugenics movement. And then in the 1920s, this twin method I was talking about, comparing identical and fraternal twins. And again, I want to emphasize reared together, not separated, not reared apart, reared together twins. This started in the 1920s, and the first psychiatric twin study was 1928. It was a German schizophrenia twin study, and they've been going on ever since. You know, to this day, they're being published all the time, so it hasn't stopped, but have gotten much more frequent. So psychiatric twin studies have been going on for close to 100 years.
One of the most, I think, striking pieces of evidence that I read, and was the difference in, I think, schizophrenia rates between fraternal twins who were both boys versus both girls. I don't know if that's ringing a bell to you, that there was a higher rate for both boys, and that cannot be interpreted as, well, boys are more prone to schizophrenia, because they're not. It's approximately equal, 50-50. So that suggests that there must be, you know, something about being the same sex that confers a more similar environment.
I think it's actually female pairs tend to be more concordant than male pairs, but Don Jackson, who is a famous family therapist who wrote a devastating critique of twin studies about 60 years ago. But that's true. Although, you know, if you look at the statistics, it's not, a striking difference. But here's another one. Same sex versus opposite sex.
Well, that was it. Okay.
Fraternal twins. Same genetic relationship to each other. They're usually not studied, but there have been, seven or eight schizophrenia twin studies, especially the older ones, that did compare concordance rate. Actually, there was also one in 2007. So the concordance rate, you know, when they both have it, that's concordance, is 2 to 3 times higher for same-sex fraternal versus opposite-sex fraternal, even though they both have the same genetic relationship to each other, averaging 50%. That's a powerful argument against genetic interpretations of twin studies, one which the genetic researchers really have no answer for that. They absolutely have no way to explain that other than just not talk about it very often.
So you're saying they're not even willing to say that, okay, so the environment is important? You know, that you could still have some genetic influence maybe, but not as much?
Oh, they will say the environment's important, but they will say the genetic foundation, this is what they say, the genetic foundation is very strong. They use this term heritability. People have probably heard that term. It's given a number, 40% heritability. So in the case of schizophrenia, they'll say schizophrenia studies show is 70% heritable, okay, which is a meaningless statistic, but they use it all the time. But they will never deny, they will always say, yes, environment is important, or environmental factors play a role or a trigger. But what I'm saying is, if you have an environmental confounding of twin studies, then really you have to throw out all the twin studies. You can't say that they prove anything about genetics. But the general position in psychiatry, for example, psychiatric disorders, is yes, you need a genetic predisposition plus environmental, usually unknown, which actually they're much less unknown than they say, but versus you need environmental triggers, but there's a genetic foundation and a high heritability, to use their term.
Right, and you're arguing that the studies prove no such thing, and that if there is a inherited vulnerability, we don't know how big it is. It may be none at all, or maybe very small. But you know, because you're able to show that the environmental variable is much, much stronger than is assumed. Now, if we were talking about, again, the assumption that the biological component is somehow important or significant, and not just statistically significant, but clinically significant. And you were saying that the confounding variables, the similarities in environment, for instance, for twins, not just for identical twins, but even for fraternal twins, especially when they're the same sex, is enormously important. So, in other words, the margin of error is so great when you take those variables into account that you really can't really say anything about genetic vulnerability?
Yes, because if you talk to most genetic researchers, let's say we talk about running in the family. You know, they do family studies where they just see how prevalent a psychiatric disorder is in a family. Most genetic research, or running in the family, most genetic researchers will admit that that doesn't prove anything about genetics, because potential genetic and environmental influences cannot be disentangled in a family study. That family members also experience more similar environment, not just more similar gene. So there we're on the same ground, that myself and critics and genetic researchers. They admit that those studies, family studies, don't prove anything about genetics. What I'm arguing, and many other critics argue, is that twin studies have the same problem. They cannot disentangle genetic and environmental influences. They're no more able than a family study or finding that something runs in the family to prove anything about genetics than is a family study. But the establishment position is the opposite. Family studies don't prove anything about genetics, but twin studies do. This is the big area of contention.
Now, have you found that your arguments, and of course there are other authors as well arguing along similar lines, has it gained any traction over the last 20-25 years since you've been writing about it?
I think that the critics are kind of, we're out there and we're largely outnumbered by kind of four people who have very powerful positions a little bit, but, you know, the dominant position is still there. So, but if that position were correct, they would have discovered many genes that are shown to cause, not just be associated with behavior. So maybe a little, but if you're a critic, sometimes that's the lot of a critic, is you put out the best argument you can. And sometimes the forces, establishment forces, are harder to influence, but knowing that at some point people will come over and understand your position.
It sounds like it's a little bit like being in a parliamentary government and you're the member of a very tiny party that will never be in the majority, but you're constantly in the opposition.
Something like that, but you always have the hope that you will be in the majority because you're right and, you know, you will be shown to be right and you will be in the majority someday. But yes, that's a pretty good analogy. Yes, it is. The other thing, can I just mention, is there's in psychiatry, another big area is adoption studies. Okay, so some people say, yes, family studies are twin studies are problematic, but aha, we have these adoption studies, and that definitively shows, for example, schizophrenia in the 60s and 70s, these adoption studies for ADHD, schizophrenia, bipolar, really definitively show. And a lot of my analysis has been about those studies, and actually those are extremely problematic studies.
And we're talking about adoption studies of particularly of identical twins raised apart, right?
No, these are not twins. These are just adoptees. So this is completely separate from a twin study.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. So what they will do is, they will find, for example, mothers who were diagnosed with schizophrenia, for example, and then they gave up children for adoption. So then they track and they identify the children they gave up for adoption and see if they're diagnosed with schizophrenia more often than are the children of mothers who are not diagnosed, a control group. The most famous ones were done in Denmark by using Danish records with American and Danish researchers in the 60s and the 70s. And those are definitive, in every textbook, those are cited as definitive evidence that schizophrenia is genetic. When actually, not at all. If you really read the studies and you really analyze what they did, they pretty much just changed definitions and groups and comparisons until they got the results that they needed to get. And should be in the area of scientific scandal why these studies have not been, very closely looked at. When just reading the publications, you can just really see the gaping holes and biases in these studies. So I wanted to make sure that I mentioned, especially in psychiatry, there's also in psychology the adoption studies of IQ and personality and other aspects.
And one of the issues, if I remember right, is that in most cases, the adoptions were not done at birth in these studies. And so if it was not done at birth and the children were taken away from unfit mothers, let's say, then presumably there was quite a bit of psychological damage before they were adopted.
That's definitely an issue, yes.
And that would increase the odds of any kind of psychiatric disorder.
Yes, so that's one aspect, one problem. But there are so many more. There's also selective placement. So, if somebody, especially a lot of these studies were carried out in societies that had very strong genetic ideas, eugenic policies, and a mother or a father, somebody who gives a child who is diagnosed as psychotic or with schizophrenia, who would want to adopt that child? They would see it as being tainted child that's going to, be crazy, psychotic. So the best, most qualified families would not take that child to be adopted. And usually they'd be much more likely to be placed into much less qualified, kind of chaotic families. So that's called selective placement. And that's kind of one of a big factor in adoption studies. which isn't really talked about that much by people who promote the studies, but it's a very major factor.
And if I'm remembering right, there were studies that looked at the psychological health of the adopting parents, and that they found that when the adopted child, even if they were, let's say, had attachment trauma, if they were placed with a healthy family, they did not develop major mental illness. But whereas if they were placed with an unhealthy family, the odds were much higher that they would.
Yes. There's one study like that, and it's in the Finnish study by Tiinari and colleagues in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And yes, they did find that. They also concluded that there's a genetic predisposition, which I would dispute that, and I've disputed that in articles and chapters. But yes, they did also look at the adoptive families and noted that even if there's a genetic predisposition, which they believe there was, that there's a protective factor of families that are stable and not chaotic for whether a child develops psychosis. Another important factor is that people who do genetic studies in psychology, psychiatry, they have a genetic bias. They believe the confirmation bias. They believe that genetic factors are important. And for the most part, they're not disinterested scientists. They have genetic beliefs, and they do these studies to confirm and promote the theories and beliefs that they have. You know, we all have confirmation bias. I have confirmation bias. Everybody has it, but it needs to be recognized that, you know, most people who do twin studies are very, believe strongly in the importance of genetic influences on behavior, and that influences their conclusions. And especially in the psychiatric adoption studies, it really influenced their conclusions. This needs to be recognized that there's a lot of bias, and bias is not bad. We're all human. We all have biases, but it just needs to be recognized that it's there.
Right. So in the hard sciences, quote unquote, hard sciences, eventually the information will win out, because there'll be contradictions that don't hold up. But I think in the social sciences and psychology, I still think of as mostly a social science, the information is not as clear cut as it is, let's say, in physics, even though there's, I think, this physics envy, that all the social sciences have. So these studies are hard to do. It's really hard to tease out variables with humans. It's certainly to do it ethically is pretty much impossible. And so, this is sort of the next best thing to, being a mad scientist who, separates children at birth and assigns them randomly. I mean, you can't do that with people. And so instead, what seems to happen is there's an overestimation of how robust the methodology is.
Yes. And, the key point is also its interpretation. That's really the key point. So they, somebody in 2015, a researcher published a meta-analysis of thousands of twin studies, and then concluded that various behaviors are this percent heritable, that percent heritable. But the point is, it doesn't matter how many of those twin studies you do, if they're all suffering from the same false assumption, it's how you interpret them. So it doesn't matter how many times you replicate it. It's about interpretation. So twin researchers interpret twin studies as proving important genetic factors, and critics interpret them as proving nothing about genetics because the results can be completely explained by environmental factors. So interpretation is key, even if you find the same result.
Right, and it's interpretation based on whether or not you believe you've teased out the variables or not. There are people that overestimate the degree to which they have been teased apart. And I wanted to bring in something about epigenetics, which is different than genetics. And it's really a pretty new field in terms of, the idea has been around for a while, but it's been gaining traction more lately. And the idea being that it's not the DNA, it's the genetic material around the DNA that responds to the environment. It turns genes on and off. And it seems through animal studies, and this is not so easy to do in humans, but through animal studies, let's say with mice, it's been shown that a stressful environment will create what looks similar to psychiatric disorders in humans. And with mice, but not with people, you can really tease apart the variables much more easily. So for instance, there's a researcher named Isabel Matsui in Switzerland who takes the sperm from stressed fathers, but then makes sure that both the sperm from stressed fathers and the comparison groups, which is sperm from non-stressed fathers, is used to impregnate the female, but then the fathers are not part of the offspring's environment at all. And they found that the offspring of the stressed fathers have these epigenetic toggle switches, if you will, set off in a vulnerable position, which they're more vulnerable to stress than the mice that had fathers that weren't stressed. And this is all very suggestive. It doesn't prove anything about humans because it's only mice. But it's very interesting, you know, to be able to tease apart variables to that extent. But you can't do that with people. I think this may be an overestimation, again, of how robust the information is going to be for people. You can use animal models, and then you have to worry about generalizability. Does it really generalize to people? What you did find, though, is that the offspring mice of distressed fathers who seem very vulnerable to what similar to depression, if they were put in an enriched environment, which for a mouse means instead of being in a little shoebox of a cage, they were given a large cage with exercise wheels and kind of like mouse heaven, they were able to change their epigenetics in such a way that they look normal again. So the idea is that epigenetics, unlike this idea of pure biological determinism, is responsive to the environment, even though it's somewhat stable. If a distressed mouse creates a distressed environment for their offspring that can go down from generation to generation, but if there's an interruption in that in the positive direction, the epigenetic influence can be reversed.
Yeah, I think this is interesting research, and I don't know that much about it. And the reason I don't is because, you know, I focus on outside of the body. We're coming back to this issue of inside the body, outside the body. So epigenetics, some of these might be very interesting findings, but I'm more concerned with improving the environment outside of the body, and we don't have to worry about whether genes switch on or switch off. You know, we eliminate poverty, we eliminate oppression, we have, you know, resources and jobs programs and all of these things and better intervention, you know, reducing stress in society. That's where I think focus should be, not on whether necessarily it turns a gene on or off. It's still an internal of the body focus.
Right. It's true. But I guess the reason why I find it intriguing is that it's a biological argument for why the environment is important. You know, so it's because anything that's physical and biological or neurological seems to carry so much more weight in the public mind. If you can show that actually the biology shows that an adequate or optimal environment is so important for mental health, then you can say, okay, now let's put our resources in that and making sure that people have an equitable start in life.
I think it is very intriguing research. I'm just saying that you don't have to, I mean, in my opinion, I don't believe we have to show a biological reason why the environment is important. It's already very obvious.
It should be.
Yeah. That it's very obvious. A child being bullied, I don't have to see anything about how genes switch on or off to know that that's harmful, or some people are more vulnerable to being depressed or being bullied on the schoolyard. It's very obvious that bad environments will harm people. And so I don't think we need a biological explanation for obvious ways to improve people's environments, reallocating resources from military spending to schools and hospitals and jobs programs, unemployment insurance. These things help people tremendously. And so they just do. And eliminating oppression and racism and those kind of things. So I don't really need to know about biology. I just need to know about people and what harms people and what helps people.
And your main work is in clinical psychology in private practice, right?
Yes, I'm a private practice clinical psychology and a psychologist. And of course, you know, those of us in the profession, and you know, you're in the profession too, you see when you work with people, you see very obvious ways that bad environments harm people. Sexual abuse, abandonment, all of these things, you know, very, very many more. Physical abuse, neglect. You know, you see how the environment really harms people. You know, genetic researchers might say that that's not scientific evidence that they harm people, so they may have a point, but it's pretty obvious to psychotherapists. Most psychotherapists, you know, realize this. They might believe there's also a genetic predisposition also, but they definitely know that the environment harms people, and good, healthy environments help people to thrive.
And of course, if policies are in place to prevent some of those stresses and setbacks, then presumably we wouldn't need as many therapists, right?
Yes, absolutely. I always say in a perfect world, you wouldn't need psychotherapists. I've always said that. And that's also a pretty strong environmentalist statement also. But we live in a very imperfect world. Gay people, they go their whole life getting negative messages about themselves. Women, ethnic minorities, people of color, anybody who's not a wealthy male Protestant in this society is oppressed in a certain degree. So the biological and the genetic theories, they kind of whitewash all this. You don't have to, don't look at that. Look at the brain, look at the genes, look at these other things. Look inside of the body to identify why people are distressed. That's a diversion. It's a way to divert people's attention from the real causes of people's distress.
Now, do you make a distinction in your mind between, let's say, everyday variety of emotional problems versus the severest end of it? So things like full-blown schizophrenia or people who have psychotic manias or, let's say, depressions that are so profound that a person can't get out of bed and can't work. So in other words, a real bona fide disability because it's so incredibly intense. So for instance, depression, for instance, used to be called melancholia, and it meant something different than what depression, the word depression has expanded to cover a much, much wider swath of the population. The same with bipolar. Bipolar used to be, when I was in graduate school in the 80s, 1 in 10,000 people, because it was only the type that included psychotic mania. And now it's supposed to be something like 4%. It's like a 4,000% increase in a decade. Probably driven in large measure by the pharmaceutical companies. But it doesn't mean that there still aren't the people in the smaller category. And those, I think it's people in those category that there's a feel or an assumption or a bias that, well, there must be something biological for them because it's so serious. And also so resistant to psychotherapy. Your psychotherapy, for when it's that profound, it has much, much smaller impact.
Yes, and that's again where we make a distinction between biology. Something can be biological and not genetic. So I guess that's, if people think about it, that's pretty obvious, right? Something, but if it's genetic, it has to be biological and not the other way around. Cancer is biological, but whether it's genetic, that's debatable, and genetic people will say something about that. But as far as bipolar disorder and genetics, I did a chapter on that, and hardly anybody's ever done a critique of that. But I looked at the evidence. This was 2006. And, the evidence wasn't there. It was twin studies and some adoption studies that were massively flawed and biased, to the extreme. There were only, I think, a couple. They're still looking for bipolar, for genes. But also that leads to the issue of, well, the one thing critics have always said that, psychiatric disorders are not diseases. They're not separate, distinct medical conditions. And that idea, it assumes there's some biological basis to say somebody has bipolar disorder as opposed to they just have behaviors that we're going to just put this category on, but it's not a disorder or a disease. Critics will say that psychiatric conditions, they're not disorders, they're not diseases, they're just kind of labels or they're kind of in a continuum of distress that people experience based on their environments.
So a moment ago you said that something can be biological without being genetic. I was wondering if we could expand on that a little bit. I guess an injury would be a good example of that. An injury is not genetic, but it's biological.
Yeah, that's a good example. Various medical conditions. Something could be biological and not caused by a hereditary predisposition. It's a disease of the body or, a brain tumor, these kinds of things. So because if something is a biological disorder, it does not imply anything about genetics. That's an important distinction.
So you're not necessarily arguing against medical interventions. I mean, you might have some skepticism about them, but you're not necessarily saying that they're always inappropriate because there may be biological consequences to trauma, let's say, that affects the way the brain works. I mean, this is speculation, of course. And that if psychotherapy alone doesn't seem to be helping enough, then you have the option of adding a psychopharmacological intervention as well. And of course, there are people who prefer, I mean, there are plenty of people in the population that really are averse to psychotherapy for whatever reason, whether it's a cultural reason or a personal reason, a familial reason, and they're only interested in a medication, if anything. So that's sort of another complicating factor.
Right. Even if something's not biological or not genetic, does not mean that you should not take medication for it. I mean, I have a lot of critique about, you know, the medications and whether they work and how they're marketed and advertised, antidepressants in particular. But just to give an example, you know, there's a certain unnamed cable news network. If I watch that, I might develop a headache and I might take Tylenol. But that doesn't mean I have a genetic predisposition, a brain disorder, a chemical imbalance. It doesn't mean any of those things. It means environmental stimuli caused a headache in my brain. And I might take that's a medical intervention if I take Tylenol. It's a medical or Advil. It's a medical intervention, but it doesn't mean that it's a biological disorder in my brain or a genetically inherited disorder.
Right. It's biologically mediated. You know, your brain is doing something, but it doesn't mean that it's because of a defect in your brain.
Right. I mean, the brain is involved in everything we do. So the brain is mediated in everything. But a lot of these things we don't call genetic, we don't call biological, even though they're mediated by the brain. Everything we do, every aspect of being human is mediated through the brain.
And if Tylenol takes your headache away, it doesn't mean that your brain chemistry was missing Tylenol.
Exactly.
Right, you had a Tylenol deficit.
Right. And on the other side, you could have somebody that has a true genetic disorder that you would have an environmental intervention. For example, let's say that a child has genetically, their hearing is impaired for genetic and inherited a gene, which they will actually find the gene, and they have a hearing impairment because of their genes or a vision impairment. We all wear, you know, glasses. You might take that child and seat them in the front of the room. You might make an environmental intervention to, reduce the impact of something that actually really is genetic. For example, those examples I just gave. So it works both ways.
No, I was wanted to return a little bit to the idea of genetic vulnerability. There are a couple of problems. I think, as you mentioned, there are no genes, or few if any studies find genes, and when they do, they don't get replicated. And one of the responses, I guess, by people who believe in the genetic component of mental illness say, well, we just haven't found it yet. But it seems to me that you know, if there are genes, there could be so many of them, and not necessarily in any way a defect, but just a difference in propensities. So for example, and this is purely speculative, it could be that there's a small correlation between suggestibility as a personality trait and capacity for delusional thinking. There could be a small, or maybe not so small, correlation between creativity and bipolar 1, the kind that involves manic episodes. And so there could be personality styles that would lend itself to mental distress being expressed in one way versus the other way. But that doesn't necessarily mean that there was something wrong in the development of the brain. And so you there would be a propensity only.
Yes, which is not necessarily genetic, but just some kind of coping mechanism. That's a big word used in psychotherapy. So, you know, all therapists, you know, we see people as children. They have very, you know, difficult, abusive conditions, and they cope differently. One is, you know, like saying that they're miserable, horrible, defective person, and another one, you know, would say, well, I'm going to dedicate myself to school and, you know, succeeding so I can get out of here. So there's different coping mechanisms people have, you know, on the basis of bad environments. But people who have severe psychiatric diagnoses, I mean, many, you know, the studies is about deprivation, abandonment, abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse. There's a lot of that in most of the histories of people, especially psychosis. The book Models of Madness, which I have a chapter in, but John Reed is one of the editors. It's an excellent book about psychosis, and it really documents a lot of the environmental adverse conditions that people experience who eventually develop psychotic disorders or diagnosis of psychosis.
And that's very different than, I think, in the popular conception that something like schizophrenia, a child can be completely normal until they reach late teens, early 20s, and suddenly their mind snaps, you know, and they become schizophrenic. And I guess what you're saying is that most of the time that's not the case. I mean, it's possible, I suppose, but it's hard to know what's going on behind closed doors. But I know that, for instance, Gregory Bateson had this idea of the double bind theory of schizophrenia, that young people who become schizophrenic, they have parents who are giving them directives in opposite directions and drives them crazy, basically. And that got, I guess, got discredited. It doesn't mean that there isn't other forms of trauma. It's not so simple.
Yes, it's more than just trauma. I mean, it's something about the structure of the society, the capitalist society, you know, we live in. Because, I mean, we didn't have schizophrenia, whatever that is, and it's a very debatable concept. And 500 years ago, I mean, there were people with brain disorders, crazy people that probably had real biological conditions. This is something, you know, more recent. And even when you're talking about bipolar disorder, yes, I mean, more people are exhibiting these symptoms. There's something about the society we live in that is unhealthy for people to live in, especially the United States compared to other places. I mean, if you were to have universal health care from birth in the United States, you would have a lot less anxiety. Just that one thing alone, you would have less anxiety. People wouldn't be worried about not paying for medical bills. Oh my God, I lost my job. I'm not going to have health insurance for my 5 kids and my wife. Just that one act. But the people who don't want to pay for that would rather fund research to have you believe that anxiety is caused by a genetic predisposition and a chemical imbalance. So there's a lot of economic forces at work. So there's things about the society that cause people distress. It's complicated. I mean, right now, you know, we're seeing all these mass shootings going on. What is it about these alienated, lonely young men? Various reasons, you know, that are causing them to do these things. It's not, you know, there's something really wrong with the society, and we need to look at society, the social policies, political policies, and, you know, not people's brains. That's a diversion from the real causes of what's going on and the distress people have. And even people who are doing very well financially in the United States are taking antidepressants, and they're depressed, and they're taking pills. And what is it in the UK? It's like 25% of the people are on antidepressants. I don't think it's that high, but it's been increasing steadily. So many people are not doing well. Even with medication, they're not making people less depressed. They're not necessarily leaving symptoms. So we need to look at the bigger picture of society, not inside the body. That's what I keep coming back to. And if the genetic evidence were there, then it would be there, and we would deal with it. But what I and many critics argue is that the genetic evidence is claimed to be there, but if you really look at it carefully, it's extremely faulty, and it's based on false assumptions and bad research and biased research, and it just isn't there.
Well, getting back to the bias from the consumer end, I mean, it seems to me that there would be a huge market for a pill that cured obesity. If people could just pop a pill, you know, once or twice a day and have a lean body, they would do it. And whether or not it has a biological cause, I mean, I think most people would agree that obesity probably has some biological component, but of course it has a huge environmental component. And, you know, people who come to the United States from another country, that ethnic group has higher rates of obesity here than they did in the previous country, probably having to do with diet and maybe also movement and exercise patterns. But nevertheless, regardless of how strong the component, the biological component is, I think as a society in the United States, there's a bias toward wanting it to the easier solution. And, you know, and that's understandable.
And if there were a pill that was safe to take that would eliminate, you know, the pounds would come off, I mean, and it were safe and it were totally, you know, transparently shown exactly what possible side effect. I mean, I'm all for that. I'm all for if there were an antidepressant that really had no side effects and didn't, and that people really talked about, you know, what the possible problems with these drugs are and they really help people. You know, I would be in favor of that. But a lot of times, you know, the research is kind of questionable whether how much they help. But in the case of obesity, okay, what's one of the big reasons in the United States, for example, marketing fast food, marketing, you know, mass advertisement of very unhealthy food? If you were the fast food industry had a lobby and they were financing research, they would finance research trying to show that obesity is highly heritable, genetic, maybe a malfunction of the brain. They would be trying to divert attention from their hamburgers and cheeseburgers and fried chicken and ice cream that they're mass marketing, you know, to kids on cartoons and to us on TV to get us to buy very unhealthy food that makes us overweight. They would not want to be financing research to show that their foods cause people to have ill health. And that also goes on with a lot of how research is funded in the United States and other places. That industries that have an interest in, you know, pollution, let's say cancer. Okay, obviously cancer, I'm not an expert in cancer, I'm not a medical doctor, but poisons, toxins in the environment play a big role in cancer, obviously. And the industries that make profit from that, they don't want us to look at that. They want to talk about the curing it or biological predispositions or genes or lifestyle changes. They don't want us to look at the toxins because that would reduce profits to have to clean up toxins, for example. So that's another example of the environment.
Yeah, I think the interest in keeping things as it is in the interest of everybody. So it's in the interest of the people making profit from people doing things the same way, and the people doing the same way wanted to keep doing things the same way also. I mean, people who love going to for fast food would love to be able to continue doing so because it's inexpensive and it's they like the taste or whatever. You know, I'm not with them, but so I think it's not just that people are being manipulated. I think the manipulation is also tapping into popular preferences.
Their preferences, but they're, you know, if they're unhealthy, the industries that they spend billions of dollars on advertising to get people to buy more. So if you have an example of cigarettes, you know, advertising for cigarettes, for tobacco, has been severely restricted. People are not prohibited from buying it. But, and the idea that the advertising will make a lot more people smoke cigarettes, for example. So it was prohibited, but they don't do that for McDonald's or Wendy's or, ice cream. So the advertising is, you know, recognized. They pay billions of dollars because they get a lot more people to buy the products.
So in the last few minutes, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, without any identifying information, of course, how you would approach this with clients who, let's say, are open to hearing about it. Is this something that comes up when you're talking to clients, or is it more of a separate research interest of yours?
It's a separate research interest, but it does come up sometimes. Sometimes clients read my work, but not usually, but sometimes they do. I just tell people who think that they have a genetic predisposition to depression or whatever it is, you know, there's no evidence that there's anything wrong with your genes. I often say to them, your genes are no less healthy than my genes. You know, there's no evidence that you have any genetic problem why you're depressed or you have anxiety or whatever, you know, reason you're coming in. Your genes are fine. I tell them that because that's my 25-year analysis of this. That's my opinion. And I also say, too, that doesn't mean I'm right. I mean, other people have other opinions. You'll go into textbooks and you read something different. But in my opinion, that can be liberating for people, but it can be upsetting for people, too, especially, say, people with bipolar disorder. A lot of times they have something that can be very destabilizing to think that they don't have a biological disorder or genetic disorder, that maybe they feel like there's something more wrong with them. Their character is really flawed. There's something wrong with their character. And this is something that can be more frightening, upsetting to people than I have a genetically caused biological disorder.
So some people actually prefer to think of themselves as having a biological disorder. It maybe is, in some way reassuring that it's not because of the way they've lived their life or because of anything they can change. And it takes them, I don't want to use the word take them off the hook, but it's reassuring in some way. And I was remembering something from earlier in a conversation I was going to say about a survey research about attitudes towards schizophrenia. That what would be the difference in public perceptions if people believed it was primarily a biological disorder versus not. And it turned out that at least in this one study, that the stigma was actually greater when the respondent thought that schizophrenia was biologically determined. And I think the interpretation was that would mean that the person is really broken and that they're determined to be that way. And that's actually more of a stigma when I think as it's communicated by the psychiatric establishment is saying, no, it's biological. You don't have to feel bad about it. It's just like having diabetes, let's say, like diabetes 1. So don't feel bad about it. It's just you were born with this. But in fact, there's more stigma if you're born with something very often.
Which is fascinating if you compare that to to real medical disorders, right? So there isn't a stigma if people have diabetes. There isn't a stigma. There's something really wrong with your character, right? So right, real medical disorders, there really isn't that stigma. But psychiatric disorders, which are claimed to be medical disorders, they're not. But they claim to be that they are, people view that differently. I think that's an interesting thing for people to think about, even though they're supposedly the same.
It's almost as if the stigma gets amplified if it's biological. You start out with that it's more stigmatized, and then if you add the biology, whereas something that's not stigmatized to begin with, and you add the biology to it, then it's even less. So it's sort of an interactive effect, I think.
But not only for psychiatric disorder.
Right, exactly.
But only for psychiatric disorders, not for real medical conditions. Like a brain tumor. No, if somebody has a brain tumor, right, that nobody says, you know, there's something, you know, I'm going to stigmatize you. They sympathize that you have this condition and hope that you can get treatment for it. You're not stigmatized for having a brain tumor or a kidney problem. You need dialysis. You know, you're not stigmatized for that. But you are for psychosis or schizophrenia, especially, as you said, if people think that it's biological, they might stigmatize you more. It should just give us kind of food for thought of thinking about how we perceive what are both claimed to be, all these things are claimed to be medical conditions, but some we kind of deep down know that they aren't so much. That's why you have a different reaction to kidney problem versus schizophrenia.
Anyway, I really appreciated having you on the show. Unfortunately, we're out of time. So thank you so much for coming to Delving In. Jay Joseph, a clinical psychologist practicing in the San Francisco Bay Area with a very strong interest in nature-nurture issues and critique of the genetic research about major mental illness, or not only major mental illness. So thank you so much.
And thank you very much. It's been really enjoyable talking with you. I appreciate it. You're inviting me on the show.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.